British Sky Broadcasting presents The Exorcism of Emily Rose, starring Laura Linney as Erin Bruner, Tom Wilkinson as Father Moore, Campbell Scott as Ethan Thomas, and Jennifer Carpenter as Emily Rose. This film is based on a true story. The film's written by Paul Harris Boardman and Scott Derrickson. It's directed by Scott Derrickson. It's voiced by Stephen O'Neill on behalf of MCS Agency. A barbed wire fence emerges out of the mist. The wire seems to be dripping blood. Then lines of an agricultural crop stand swaying in the breeze. They're brown and withered. Pumpkins lie rotting in the soil. An old colonial-style farmhouse stands in the middle of the land, wood-fronted and imposing. The snow falls gently. A figure approaches the building, walking along the frosty turf. The figure walks up the steps onto the veranda, which encircles the house. It's an older man. He wears a dark hat and coat. He looks round in the doorway and coughs gently. He retreats down the steps away from the veranda and back out onto the grass. He looks over at an old tractor parked by a rusting barn. A weather vane with a figure of a little horse on top of it sways in the breeze. He looks down. A couple of cats disappear into the hedge. He turns back round to the house, and with a somber look, he takes a few steps back towards it. He looks up at a beehive in the eaves of the roof. He glances at a first floor window, behind which a man's face emerges out of the gloom. The men look at each other. The one inside the upper room retreats. A woman opens the front door and stands in the shadows.
You're the medical examiner?
The man nods and steps up to the house. Inside, a young man and three young women are sitting round a kitchen table with solemn looks. The woman leads the medical examiner to the foot of the stairs. The man stops and looks at another man in a checked shirt who's staring into space.
Mr. Rose.
Mr. Rose turns his head slightly but says nothing. The medical examiner glances at the woman. Then the examiner is proceeding down a dark corridor. A door opens at the end of the corridor, and a middle-aged man with dark hair, wearing a priestly dog collar, steps out from behind it. He hesitates for a moment in front of the medical examiner and heads off. The examiner enters the room. A policeman with a sheriff's badge on his jacket closes the door. Then Mr. Rose and the young man are sitting at the kitchen table. The priest is staring at the clock nearby. The woman, the examiner, and the policeman enter the kitchen. The medical examiner has an expression of grave concern.
Sorry, Mr. Rose. But I cannot state conclusively that the cause of death was natural. Your daughter, she...
The young policeman speaks.
Excuse me, Father. Father Moore. You'll have to come with me.
The priest stares out at the barn and a tractor. Then more policemen are leading him towards the court building.
Father Moore!
Father Moore!
Father, tell us about the exorcism! Over here, Father Moore!
I'm here at Crescent County Courthouse this afternoon as we show you Father Richard...
What about the parents?
They're not talking to the police.
Did we charge them?
No, even the priest admits he ran the show. I need a Christian on this. Preferably a Catholic. Somebody that knows this shit inside out and who the public will see as unbiased. We're going after a holy man here.
Ethan Thomas. He's not Catholic, though. Methodist, I think. But the guy practically lives at church. Choir practice, teaches Sunday school.
Yeah, he's no choir boy in the courtroom. I've seen him tear people up on cross. He's a shrewd son of a bitch.
The smart lawyers exchange glances in their conference room.
All right, pull him off whatever he's doing. He's lead prosecutor.
A cocktail glass on a bar, empty except for a couple of olives. An attractive woman with shoulder-length blonde hair is writing notes, leaning on the bar next to the glass. She looks up. A group of men in dark suits are standing nearby. One of them beckons her over. The woman stuffs her papers in her bag and moves towards them.
Now there's ambition. She never stops. She even works while she drinks. Gentlemen, you know Aaron Brunner?
Of course.
Hello.
I was so sure that Van Hopper would fry, but you proved me wrong, lady.
The system worked, that's all.
Gentlemen, you'll excuse us, will you? Have you seen the news about this priest?
I heard something about an exorcism gone bad, but I don't know the details.
The DA charged him with negligent homicide. They offered a very reasonable plea bargain, but the priest turned it down.
Carl, do not ask me to take
this kid. The Archdiocese specifically requested you.
Why me?
Because they followed the Van Hopper trial like everybody else. They think you're smart and convincing. They want you to ask the priest to reconsider a deal.
Well, what if he won't? This case sounds like a quagmire. If I'm smart, I'll leave it alone.
Aaron, the Van Hopper case got you back on the fast track. Once again, you're a rising star. Shivas, neat, please.
Tangri Martini Dry. What are you saying?
I'm saying you do this for me, and the rising star keeps rising. The case is yours.
Erin shakes her head slightly.
Just how high do I get to rise this time?
Carl looks down.
I've been junior partner for too long now, Carl. It's not like other firms haven't been calling.
Erin.
I want my name on the door right next to yours.
Okay. Try to get the deal. If the priest won't do it and this does go to trial, the Archdiocese feels his testimony could be an embarrassment. So under no circumstances is he to testify.
No, of course. If I put James Van Hopper on the stand, he'd be marking time on death row instead of sunbathing on Miami Beach. His tab.
The smart bald man watches Erin leave the bar. Then, dressed in a dark suit, Erin follows a male prison guard walk in front of a row of cells. The guard slides open the bars of one of the cells and Erin enters. Father Moore is lying on a small army bed dressed in an orange boiler suit with one arm covering his face.
Good morning, I'm Aaron Brunner. May I sit down?
They brought the chair for my public defender. I guess they left it here when they decided I wasn't going to kill myself with it.
Erin sits in the little metal chair at the foot of his bed. She clasps her hands together and crosses her legs.
My firm represents the Archdiocese.
Yes. Yes, I was expecting them to send someone. Why did they choose you?
I wanted this case.
So you like the spotlight?
I'm used to it. I defended James Van Hopper.
Now you've come here to further your celebrity?
No. I'm here to make senior partner of my firm.
Moore is sitting on the edge of the bed.
Are you a Catholic?
No. I'm an agnostic, I guess. I'm not really sure.
If you're not sure, then you are one. I'm sorry, but I don't think you're the right attorney for me. I think I'll stick with my public defender.
He can't get the DA to get you a better deal. I can.
I won't be making any plea agreement.
If you don't, the Archdiocese won't post your bail. You'll be stuck in here for the duration of the trial.
The priest looks at the floor.
Father, do you understand how long they can put you away for this?
It's been explained to me.
The district attorney's office doesn't like it when religion holds itself above the law. And this prosecutor, Ethan Thomas, you're going to need somebody hungry and smart and aggressive to even have a chance.
And what would your strategy be to defend me against such a formidable man?
That depends.
On what?
On how you want to be defended.
He stares at her thoughtfully.
What's your main concern? Other than staying out of jail, is it how you're being portrayed in the media?
I don't care about my reputation. I'm not afraid of jail. What I care about is telling Emily Rose's story. I want people to hear what only I can tell.
And what is that?
What really happened to Emily and why?
He looks at her with a determined expression.
If I let you defend me, Will you promise to let me testify and tell the truth about what happened to Emily?
And what is the truth you would tell? That the ritual killed her? Was it your fault she died?
No.
All right, then I'll let you tell her story, but only if you agree to let me do whatever else it takes to win.
The priest turns his head into the shadows and nods. Later, at the farmhouse, Erin is sitting on a sofa. A cat hisses next to her. Erin looks at a statuette of the Virgin Mary and a crucifix on the wall.
You're not used to this kind of place. I'm sure our life is very strange to you.
Mrs. Rose brings in a teapot.
Not so strange. I grew up in a little town. But our house wasn't as nice or as big as this. My mother, she raised me alone. She was a school teacher, so we had very little money.
What a wonderful thing to be. That was Emily's dream, to be a teacher. That's why she went away to the university.
Erin thinks to herself and nods. She smiles and looks round the room.
A lot of cats live here.
There are 11 now, I think. Emily always brought them home ever since she was a little girl. She couldn't leave a stray abandoned.
Erin puts down her cup and faces Mrs. Rose.
Before these troubles began, was Emily a happy girl?
Oh, yes. Before she went away to university, my Emily was so very happy.
Two girls are jumping on a bed.
What is going on?
A pretty dark-haired girl gets off the bed and holds out a piece of paper.
Mama.
Is it?
It's a scholarship, Mama. They pay for it. They pay for everything.
This is your dream, Emily. You'll be leaving us.
It's okay.
Emily smiles at her mother.
I'll be okay.
I'm going to show this to your father.
Emily looks down proudly. Then in a bar, Erin is looking at a newspaper with the headline, Exorcism Trial Set to Begin.
Counselor, thanks for meeting me.
Sure. Can I buy you a drink, Mr. Thomas? No, he makes an excellent martini.
Just water for me, please. So, the judge thinks we should offer your client a new plea agreement. Apparently she feels the community might be better served without this trial.
How do you feel about it? Personally.
My job is to represent the interests of the people. I make an effort to be objective.
I ask because I know you're a churchgoer. Now you're set to prosecute a man of God.
Your priest broke the law, and a young girl is dead. If he's a man of God, then personally, I think he's even more subject to the laws of moral behavior and punishment. If it were up to me, he'd get no deal at all.
What about forgiveness and compassion? Isn't that part of your creed? Or does that just get in the way of your work?
Ethan has trimmed dark hair and a moustache.
If you have compassion for your client, counselor, you'll persuade him to accept this. Charges reduced to reckless endangerment. 12 months in a county jail. Reducible to 6 plus probation, if he can stay out of trouble. Somehow I expect he can manage that. But please understand me. If he refuses, I will seek the maximum.
Father Moore's made it clear there will be no plea agreement. He will not lie. He will not admit to something he is not guilty of. And he was never neglectful of Emily.
Never neglectful? Have you seen the postmortem photographs?
Erin looks hesitant. She picks up her cocktail glass.
We'll go to trial. My client wants the public to know the truth.
Good. So do I. Have a good night, counsel.
Erin thinks to herself. Then, in her apartment, pages of handwritten notes are strewn across a table. A post-it note stuck to one of the papers says, Gambutrol, side effects? It's dark. Erin is sitting in the shadows, perched on her sofa, hunched over her notes. She rubs her eyes wearily. Then she turns and picks up a large cushion. She hugs it against her tummy and sits back on the sofa, picking up and pointing the remote control. She picks up a large glass of red wine and drinks. Later that night, she's in bed. Her silver wristwatch is lying on a little table next to her bed. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. The watch stops. The next morning, people are approaching the courthouse.
Let the record show that the defendant and his counsel are present and that the jury is seated. Mr. Thomas, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ethan Thomas. I'm the assistant district attorney, and I represent the people. In the case before you, the evidence will show that the victim had a serious medical condition that demanded medical treatment. We will prove that the victim's condition rendered her physically and psychologically incapable of caring for herself. Her care was then wholly entrusted to that man, the defendant, Father Richard Moore. She became his responsibility, and he betrayed that responsibility by persuading her to abandon her medical treatment in favor of religious treatment. A ritual exorcism performed by the defendant, allegedly to cure the victim by ridding her of demonic forces. We will demonstrate that this course of action directly resulted in the victim's death. I said a moment ago that I represent the people. We all know what that means, but it's a little abstract, isn't it? Miss Bruner, the attorney for the defense, is seated right next to the man she represents. And I stand here to represent the people. That's not really why I stand here today. I'm here on behalf of someone who can't sit at a table and look at you every day and gain your sympathy. Someone who can't take the stand to testify and tell you what happened in her own words.
Ethan wears a dark suit and tie.
A young girl that could have been your daughter, could have been mine. A girl who trusted Father Richard Moore with her life.
Ethan fingers a brown paper file. He pulls out a photo and holds it up.
This is what she looked like.
The photo is a portrait of Emily smiling.
Before the defendant began his religious treatment. This is a photograph taken of her on the day that she died.
Again, a photo of her face, which is covered in cuts and bruises. The jury appears shocked. Ethan holds up the photo and parades it somberly as he walks in front of the row of jury members. Erin watches and blinks.
I stand here for Emily Rose, who died horribly at age 19. You won't be able to see Emily sitting here day after day during this trial, but I hope you'll remember her as she was when she was alive. And full of hopes and dreams. And as she was when Father Richard Moore was finished with her and left her to die. Thank you.
Is the defense prepared to make its opening statement?
Erin gets to her feet.
Your Honor, I would like to reserve my opening statement until the presentation of the defense's case.
As is your privilege. Prosecution may begin.
Don't worry, that was already my plan.
Thank you, Your Honor. The people called Dr. Edith Vogel.
I've known Emily her entire life. I took care of all of the Rose girls.
Can you describe Emily as you knew her growing up?
She was a bit sickly in her early years. She stayed inside a lot, reading, learning music.
How did she feel about going away to school?
Objection, speculation, the witness is not a psychiatrist.
I'll rephrase. Did you talk to Emily about going off to college?
Yes, she told me she was excited, but nervous that she would be away from her family in the big city. This was an overwhelming change for her.
Did you stay in touch after she went away?
Yes, she wrote me a letter saying that she'd been to a dance and she'd met a boy named Jason. She didn't want her mother to know this because her mother did not approve of dancing and had warned her about the boys at school.
And did Emily communicate with you again last fall after you received the letter?
Actually, it was her mother. She telephoned me, waking me out of a deep sleep at 4 a.m. She asked me to call Emily at a payphone on the university campus. When Emily answered, she was quite hysterical. At first, she just sobbed uncontrollably. but eventually she calmed down enough to tell me what had happened. She said that she was alone that weekend. Her roommate had gone home.
Nighttime. Emily is lying in a bed. The clock shows it's 3 o'clock.
She had awakened and thought she smelled something burning. There was no alarm, but she got up, afraid there was a fire.
Emily gets out of bed and walks through the darkness. She opens the door and steps into the corridor. She looks behind her at the closed double doors. The corridor is shadowy. A faint orange light runs along the top of it, bathing Emily in a red glow. With a look of concern, Emily proceeds slowly along the corridor. She glances down, one hand gripping the elbow of her other arm. She spins round. One of the double doors behind her is swinging open. As it continues to open and close, Emily strides towards it. She reaches it and closes it. She stays for a moment, checking that the door is securely shut, then turns and moves away. She heads back into her room and shuts the door. She retreats back into her bed and lies down in the darkness. She glances at a glass pot containing pencils on the desk by her bed. As she watches, the container starts to move. It slides off the edge of the desk. Emily sits up. Suddenly, a red blanket starts to slowly move itself off the bed. As the young woman sits there, the bed itself seems to be alive. The mattress starts to dip in the middle. Emily is thrust onto her back. Her body starts to descend into the mattress. Her neck tightens, and she puts her hands to her throat, as if trying to pull something off. Her nightdress rises up. Again, she puts her hands to her neck. Her nightdress rises again. Her arms flail in the air, as if she's struggling against an invisible power. Her hands are pinned against the pillow. She shakes her head violently. With tears in her eyes, she flings herself off her bed. She rushes out of her room.
Dr. Mueller, what's your position at the University Hospital?
I am chairman of the Department of Neurology.
And after you heard about the dorm room incident, what were your initial thoughts?
At first, I thought perhaps Emily had taken illegal drugs, some type of hallucinogen. But we ran tests and found no trace of drugs in her system. And the more she explained the incident to me, the more I began to suspect something else. Epilepsy results from rapid, uncontrolled electrical activity in the brain. In a severe or grand mal seizure, a person may lose consciousness for several minutes and suffer involuntary contractions of all the muscles of the body.
Is it possible for a person suffering from such a seizure to have hallucinations or perceive the things that Emily described?
The muscle contractions could feel like an extreme pressure on the body. And it is certainly possible with all that brain activity for a person to perceive all sorts of strange and violent things.
So, suspecting that Emily was epileptic, how did you proceed?
I administered an electroencephalograph.
What did the EEG reveal?
It showed a possible epileptic focus in the patient's left temporal lobe.
Did this require specific treatment?
Yes, I began a medication schedule for Emily with the drug Gambutrol. I also advised regular follow-up examinations and further tests, but Emily failed to keep her follow-up appointments with me.
Did she give any reason for discontinuing these appointments?
Yes, she told me she was convinced that her condition was a spiritual one. It was the conviction of her priest, she said, and she shared his beliefs.
Doctor, was it your impression that Emily had placed her care entirely in Father
Objection,
Moore's hands?
Objection, leading the witness.
Sustained.
After the end of October, did you ask Emily why she had stopped filling her Gambutrol prescriptions?
Yes. She said that Father Moore had suggested she stop taking the drug.
And what, in your medical opinion, was the direct result of Father Moore's suggestion?
I firmly believe that Father Moore's suggestion killed her.
Objection, Your Honor. The witness is asserting outrageous conclusions based on pure hearsay evidence.
Technically correct, but I'll allow it as part of his expert opinion testimony.
Thank you, Dr. Mueller. Your witness.
Doctor, you said you observed a possible epileptic focus in the temporal lobe. Doesn't this imply that what you observed may not have been an epileptic focus?
Yes, that's also possible.
And would Father Moore's advice to stop taking Gambutrol be good advice if Emily were, in fact, not epileptic?
Of course. But that's not the case here. She was epileptic.
Really? When Emily saw objects move on their own and felt an invisible presence on top of her, was she experiencing symptoms typical of epilepsy?
Not typical, no.
Are they typical indications of any other condition, say, for example, psychosis?
Yes, I would say that's correct.
But isn't psychosis an entirely different medical condition from epilepsy?
Yes, in my experience,
it is. So, Doctor,
aren't
you selectively choosing what parts of Emily's experiences fit your epilepsy diagnosis while simply ignoring those which might indicate something else?
Objection, Your Honor. Argumentative.
Withdrawn. No further questions.
Erin walks away. Ethan looks at her thoughtfully. Then Erin is again led down a dark corridor by a prison guard along the row of cells. As the guard unlocks the sliding bars to one cell, Erin peers through the bars into the shadows in an empty chamber. She heads into Moore's cell.
We have to work fast. You're only giving me an hour with you tonight.
Listen. Before we get started, there's something I have to tell you. Something I should have said to you before I let you take the case.
Okay.
The priest looks down at the floor.
There are forces surrounding this trial. Dark, powerful forces. Just be careful, Erin. Watch your step.
I see. Look.
She smiles.
Father, you don't have to worry about me. I'm an agnostic, remember?
Look, demons exist whether you believe in them or not. Your involvement in this trial might just open you up to their attacks.
Look, Father, I appreciate your concern, but you need to be worried about yourself. Ethan Thomas is using the medical aspects of this case as ammunition, and I have to be prepared for his attacks. So, with what little time we have, I think we need to focus on your defense.
The priest contemplates this, looking at her. He nods and gets up from the camp bed.
Now, what I need from you is more information about Emily's condition, the specific details of how it progressed after the dorm room episode.
Well, after the first incident, she was sent to the university hospital for testing and observation.
Nighttime. Emily is standing by herself in a private hospital room, staring out of the window at an electrical storm. Her expression turns to horror as she seems to see a face in the storm clouds. She falls backwards onto the floor, her face racked with anguish. She seems to be being pulled backwards. Her arms flail about. She knocks a trolley of medical equipment on top of her.
Emily once told me that in her dorm room, she resisted the demons, but at the hospital, they overcame her.
So she believed that her actual possession began that night at the hospital?
Yeah. I think she did. And after that, things just went from bad to worse.
Emily is marching along a covered walkway past other college students. She wears a red coat and has a cloth bag slung over her shoulder. She trots up some steps into a college building. Then, in a badly lit classroom, a group of students are sitting at individual desks. They're sitting in exam. Most are writing. Emily is sitting at the back, staring into space with an expression of sadness. She looks at the window. The rain is pouring down it. She looks down, then glances back at the window, which steams up. She clasps her hands together and rests her head on them as she sobs. She looks round. A dark-haired male student is looking at her with concern. She looks down at her desk, then looks round at him again. Black blood spews out of his eyes. Emily leaps to her feet. The young man, now fine, resumes his concerned look. Emily grabs her bag and rushes from the classroom. She runs out of the building into the dark and the rain. She clasps her bag to her body as she runs. She stops. A car goes past with a ghostly face looking at her out of the back window. She continues to rush down a path along the edge of the college building. A couple are approaching under an umbrella. As they pass, again their eyes turn a terrifying black. Emily drops her bag and stumbles to the ground. She gets up. She rushes down a bank. She comes round a corner and heads down another path. She's completely soaked. Three young men are gathered by a hedge nearby. One spots Emily running away. It's Jason.
Emily!
Emily enters the university chapel, which is deserted apart from a pair of older women who are praying in the pew nearest the altar. Her hands slightly raised in front of her, Emily walks down the aisle. She looks down at the two women, whose eyes again blacken as they roar at her. Then the two women are rushing out of the church as Jason climbs the steps towards it. He watches them go and enters the church. Emily's pupils are fully dilated.
Emily?
Jason walks slowly down a side aisle, watching Emily, who is standing in front of the altar. He continues carefully forward, frowning thoughtfully. Emily raises her left hand towards the cross on the altar. As the young man watches, Emily's body contorts backwards till her head and shoulders are almost at a right angle to her legs.
Oh my God. Emily?
Don't touch me!
The young man stumbles backwards. Emily, as if suddenly released, slumps to the floor, trembling.
Jason, please! Don't leave me!
With a look of shock, Jason gets to his feet. He crouches by Emily. Then he's sitting next to Erin on a park bench.
And I never did leave her. I stayed until the end. So much of what we shared was like a nightmare, but I won't give up a single minute I spent with her. She woke me up, you know, to things I never felt before. Things I never knew I could feel. I never knew how dead I was until I met her.
Erin turns and looks down thoughtfully. Later, she's in a bar.
In the residential North Metro District, where James Van Hopper acquitted last year after a controversial murder trial.
Can you turn that up, please? Struck again.
It was inside this quiet suburban home that police say James Van Hopper murdered a young couple earlier today. Sources close to the investigation say that Van Hopper, who was acquitted of murder charges in April of last year, may have known both of the victims. Their names are being withheld pending family notification.
Erin stares open-mouthed at the screen with a look of concern. Then she strides into the bar's toilets, past a row of hand basins. She reaches the end wall, turns, and faces the sinks. She approaches one of them. She looks in the mirror with shock. A tall woman in a black hooded cloak washes her hands in the basin next to her. Erin shakes water off her hands and moves away. Later that night, Erin is lying in her bed asleep on her back. Her bedside clock shows it's 3 a.m. Erin opens her eyes. She has a look of mild disgust on her face. She sits up, her pink t-shirt lit by a shaft of moonlight. She gets out of bed. She heads out of the room and down a dark corridor. In the kitchen, she puts on the light. But the main light hasn't come on. She cautiously enters the upmarket kitchen. She checks the controls on the oven. She turns, still frowning in a confused manner. It goes dark. She looks up. Another ceiling light has blown. She looks round at the clock, which says 4 o'clock. She turns on the tap and half fills a glass with water. She looks round. Her front door is opening and letting in a shaft of light. Erin puts down the glass on the edge of the sink, but it drops to the floor. She very cautiously edges towards the door. Then she leaps at it and slams it shut. She locks it and puts the chain on it too. She walks past the lounge. Then she gets back into bed and pulls the sheets up around her. She lays down, hugging the pillow. Meanwhile, in Father Moore's dark cell, the priest is laying on his back on the camp bed. In the shadows, he gets up and moves towards the bars of his cell, beyond which is a window. A dark figure moves past some bars nearby. The priest grips the bars in his cell.
Most glorious prince of the heavens. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle against the princes, powers, and rulers of darkness.
He looks back at the bars. The figure has disappeared. He looks up. Daytime, the courtroom. Ethan looks at his watch. At the opposite desk, Father Moore has his head bowed. Erin is not in her seat. Erin walks in holding some files.
Councillor Bruner, my courtroom day begins at 9:30 a.m.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Which was 17 minutes ago.
The judge has grey-brown hair and glasses.
Ready to proceed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Dr. Briggs, please state your qualifications for the court.
I have advanced degrees in medicine, psychiatry, and neurology from Johns Hopkins, and I have had 3 books and several dozen papers published in the fields of neurology and neuropsychiatry.
What was the cause of death, as determined by the autopsy?
The decedent expired due to a gradual shutdown of her bodily functions.
Why did her body shut down?
The autopsy found that it was a cumulative effect from numerous physical traumas exacerbated by malnutrition, which severely inhibited her ability to recuperate from those traumas. In other words, her starving body had little or no means to recover from the injuries it was sustaining, and so it eventually just gave out.
How did Emily get these injuries?
Some were the result of violent epileptic seizures, and some were self-inflicted.
And why, in your opinion, did Emily injure herself? And why did she stop eating?
Upon review of her complete medical file, I concluded that Emily's epilepsy had evolved into a condition known as psychotic epileptic disorder. This is a rare development, to be sure, but one that I have witnessed numerous times.
You mean that Emily was both epileptic and psychotic?
Yes.
Please explain how this psychotic epileptic disorder would manifest itself.
The seizures would have the characteristic symptoms of schizophrenia, such as auditory and visual hallucinations, and sometimes extreme paranoia. The seizures may lock up the joints and slightly contort the body, and the pupils will dilate, making the eyes appear black.
So you believe that Emily had epilepsy, which developed into a form of violent psychosis, a condition that can be controlled with the drug Gambutrol?
Yes, and it would have been if she'd continued her treatment.
Dr. Briggs, in your opinion, if Emily had continued with her medication, would she be alive today?
Absolutely. If treated early, psychotic epileptic disorder is rarely fatal. I mean, this was a very sick girl. The defendant should have realized that Emily was in need of continued medical treatment.
Thank you, Doctor. Your witness.
Ethan and Erin cross paths on the black and white floor.
Doctor, you testified that Gambutrol could have controlled Emily's condition. How do you know that?
It's the inevitable result of taking the drug. Gambutrol would have controlled her epileptic seizures, which were the root cause of her psychosis.
But wasn't Emily still experiencing psychotic symptoms even after she started taking the medication?
Yes, because Gambutrol has a cumulative effect. It takes time to build up in the patient's system.
So you assume that Gambutrol would have helped her, but you don't know that it would.
It's a reasonable assumption, but no, of course, I can't be certain.
Doctor, is psychotic epileptic disorder a common medical term, or did you just make it up?
I distinguished and named the illness
so,
while writing about
psychotic
it in the
Oxford. Epileptic disorder is really just
Objection,
your own pet theory.
Sustained.
When Emily chose to stop her medical treatment, what exactly do you think should have been done?
Upon recognizing her condition, I would have tranquilized her and force-fed her. And then, if necessary, I would have treated her with electroconvulsive therapy.
Electroshock treatment?
Hmm?
You would have done this against her will.
To save her life?
Erin stares at him.
Absolutely.
A number of the jurors give thoughtful looks to Erin.
Nothing further.
Erin moves away with an expression of shock.
The witness may step down.
Your Honor, I offer into evidence this photograph as People's Exhibit 3A, and having done so, the people rest.
The photograph is entered into evidence. We are recessed until tomorrow morning, 9:30 sharp, at which time the defense will give its opening statement and call its first witness.
I'm sorry, I was late. I didn't get a lot of sleep, but a power outage knocked out my alarm clock. It won't happen again.
No, I didn't sleep either. What kept you awake?
Doesn't matter.
You're under attack.
What are you talking about?
You're in a spiritual battle, Erin. The forces of darkness are trying to keep you away from the light. Don't let them.
Don't worry about today. I'm doing fine. We're getting creamed. I can't believe I walked right into that. If we don't find a doctor to testify that Emily wasn't epileptic or schizophrenic or schizoepileptic, we're gonna lose.
Care of the city's main branch and the university library, I bring you another dozen fun-filled books about the demonic and mentally deranged.
A history of possession.
Used to burn women at the stake during witch hunts for being demon-possessed. Be glad you don't have to defend those guys.
How are we doing on our medical experts?
Not good. The psychiatrist you wanted is tied up in another trial, and the neurologist is sailing to Costa Rica.
This book I'm reading, it's by an anthropologist. It's about contemporary cases of possession, mostly in the third world.
Of course, people there are still primitive and superstitious.
Maybe. Maybe they see possession for what it really is. Maybe we've taught ourselves not to see it.
Are you saying you believe in this stuff?
No. I'm saying maybe we shouldn't just try to invalidate the prosecution's case by punching holes in the medical approach. Maybe we should also try to validate the alternative.
Her assistant breathes out and sits back in his chair.
Validate possession.
In a court of law?
Yes.
Okay. I guess we could bring in some priests to talk about exorcisms that they performed if we could find
any. No, the Archdiocese won't let us do that. They want to limit the church's exposure to Father Moore and no one else. But I've got three articles by the anthropologist who wrote this book. She approaches the subject of possession from a scientific perspective and doesn't try to debunk it.
You want me to track her down?
Yeah. Keep looking for a medical expert to refute Dr. Briggs, but send the case file to this Dr. Sadira Adani.
Next day.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, as you know by now, my name is Erin Bruner, and I represent the defendant, Richard Moore. Mr. Thomas has contended that Emily Rose suffered from a serious medical condition that required medical treatment, nothing more. He has asserted that any attempt by my client to help Emily by anything other than medical means was not only inappropriate, but criminally negligent. I'm now going to ask that you keep an open mind to what our evidence and testimony will show. Medical treatment was not the answer for Emily, because she simply did not suffer from a medical condition. She was neither epileptic nor psychotic. Emily Rose's condition, in fact, was demonic possession, and exorcism was her only hope for a cure. Some of you may find yourself unable to reconcile Emily's beliefs or those of the defendant with your own. You may not believe demons exist. You won't have to, because you will see that after the utter failure of the doctors to help Emily, Father Moore simply tried to help Emily in a different way, using an approach that he, Emily, and her family firmly believed was her only chance for relief. And we will show that despite his greatest efforts and his sincere love for Emily, there was absolutely nothing Father Richard Moore could have done to prevent the death of Emily Rose.
The university canteen, Emily and Jason sit opposite each other.
Are you okay? Is she gonna eat anything?
Emily has taken a pill. She stares woozily down at her tray of food. She looks round at several other students tucking into their meals nearby. A young man raises a glass of iced water to his mouth. Another chops up some chicken, another tucks into some sponge pudding. Emily turns her face away and, with a look of anguish, puts her hands over her ears.
She said it was terrible to hear the clinking of spoons and forks. She was always hungry, but she said they wouldn't let her eat.
Who did she mean by they?
The forces that were in control of her, that were inside her. The demons.
Tell us what else happened that night.
I walked her back to her dorm, and she seemed really nervous and scared. So I held her for a while, trying to calm her down. I fell asleep, but when I woke up, she wasn't beside me. Father, and he told me to bring Emily home.
Jason and I put Emily to bed, hoping she would sleep.
And when did Father Moore become involved?
Well, Emily stayed home after that. She didn't return to school, and she kept getting worse. Eventually, when she didn't get better, we called our priest, Father Moore. When he arrived, I sent my daughter Alice upstairs to see if Emily was awake.
Come in.
Yes.
Emily is eating dead spiders from the floor. As her sister retreats, Emily stands and scrapes her nails against the wall. She starts to kneel and stand in one movement. Her father and the priest enter the room. Emily pulls at her hair. The two men rush to her and try to restrain her. She kicks her legs out as they force her to the floor.
Emily, can you hear me? Et ego sum qui venit in nomine eius.
Non potas me expellere sacerdos.
Try. I dare you. Her rigidity is broken and she slumps to the floor. The two men roll her over. She swipes her hand at the priest's face. Later, she's staring out of a window. Then she goes back into her room. Father Moore leaves the house. He stops and looks into the room. Emily is at the piano. He watches her play. Then, back in the courtroom.
You've suffered a terrible loss, Mr. Rose. I know this is difficult. So thank you for being here today. Sir, do you often read the Bible?
Yes, I do.
So do I. What about the DSM? The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, commonly referred to as the Bible of Abnormal Psychiatry. Have you read that?
No.
So you're not aware that according to the DSM, a person's refusal to eat is a common indication of a psychiatric condition known as anorexia?
Objection. The witness just said he hasn't read the DSM, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Mr. Rose, are you aware that catatonic rigidity, specifically a locking up of the joints of the body, is a known symptom of psychosis?
No. I haven't studied these things.
Have you ever visited an insane asylum or a hospital for the treatment of the mentally ill?
Once. My aunt was in one before she died.
Really? So there's a history of mental illness in your family?
I suppose.
Sir, if you saw someone eating insects on a street corner, would you say that that person is mentally ill?
Probably, yes.
So can you really say with confidence that the behavior you saw in your daughter's bedroom that night could not be the behavior of someone suffering from psychosis?
I don't know. She never had any problems like that before, and it just didn't feel that way to me, or to Father Moore.
And you trusted him, right?
Yes. He is our parish priest.
Fair enough. And after that night, would you say that you put your daughter entirely in Father Moore's care?
Yes. We had done all we could. We said she was in his hands now. Body and soul.
Thank you. No further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. You may step down.
Erin stands up.
The defense calls Dr. Sadira Adani.
I am currently a professor of anthropology and psychiatry at Northwestern University.
Where did you receive your education?
At Yale and then at Cambridge.
And what is your specific area of expertise?
I study the spiritual experiences of people in various cultures and the physiological and psychological changes they undergo during these experiences.
Would it be accurate to say that you specialize in the scientific study of possession?
Yes. Possession is one term for a basic human experience reported by a great number of people all around the world. In my field work, I've seen many people who experienced a sense of being invaded by an entity from the supernatural realm.
Why do you think Emily was invaded? Why did this possession happen to her?
Based on my study of the case file, I believe that Emily Rose was a hypersensitive, a person with an unusual connection to what Carlos Castaneda called the separate reality. Hypersensitives are born different from everyone else. They can have visions of the future or see the dead, and sometimes be uniquely susceptible to invasion by an entity that is alien to them.
Objection!
The courtroom looks round at Ethan.
On what grounds?
How about silliness, Your Honor? A young girl suffered terribly and died. Do we have to subject her illness to this pseudo-scientific analysis?
Both counselors, please approach the bench.
This testimony is beyond ridiculous. Visions of the future are seeing the dead.
Supernatural systems are shared by millions, perhaps billions of people in the world. Her expertise is directly relevant to the issues in this case.
Bring in a witch doctor to sift through some monkey bones while we're at it.
Stop!
The judge thinks and nods.
We've read a great deal of testimony in support of a medical explanation for Emily's condition. Now we have a witness who has spent her career studying the defense's alternative explanation. An exorcism expert, if you will. I think we'll hear what she has to say. Thank you, Your Honor.
Dr. Adani, why do you think Emily's exorcism failed?
The medical treatment, specifically the drug, Gambutrol.
Please explain.
The exorcism ritual results in a specific brain activity that cuts a person off from the possession experience. But Emily's exorcism could not have achieved this because the doctor gave her Gambutrol, which has an intoxicating effect on the brain. The drug made her immune to the psycho-spiritual shock that exorcism is intended to provide.
What do you believe was the ultimate result of treatment with this intoxicating drug?
Gambutrol locked Emily in the possessed state. This left her unable to respond to the exorcism, and therefore, it directly contributed to her death.
Thank you, Doctor.
Ms. Adani nods.
No further questions.
Ethan consults with his assistant while the judge watches him. He gets up holding some papers.
I'm looking at a list of your published articles, Doctor. You've been quite busy and prolific. So, based on your time spent with holy rollers, snake handlers, voodoo priestesses, and Indians tripping on peyote buds, based on observing these bizarre individuals, you've concluded that possession is a basic, typical human experience?
I must say, Counselor, that's quite a laundry list of disdain, and one that thoroughly mischaracterizes my research. No, I don't think possession is a typical experience. But I am convinced that it is a scientifically verified, culturally universal one.
Have you ever used Gambutrol in your studies to test your theory about its effect on the possession experience?
Absolutely not. That would be dangerous to the patient.
So this notion of Gambutrol locking someone in a possessed state, the key to your assertion that somehow her medical treatment harmed Emily, this would be your own pet theory, correct? You're just making this one up?
Objection, Your Honor. Argumentative.
Sustained. Although I think he's just taking a page from your book, Counselor.
No further questions.
Ethan heads back to his seat. Erin is thoughtful. She looks at her witness and smiles. Then, outside the building...
Erin!
I've got a doctor who wants to testify. He's an eyewitness, Erin. He was there. He was at the exorcism.
What?
He called us. Dr. Graham Cartwright, Department of Abnormal Psychiatry at St. Mary's Hospital.
Erin strides up the steps back into the court building. In the entrance lobby, she stands over Father Moore, who gets to his feet.
Dr. Cartwright. Ring a bell?
Yes.
He was there?
Yes.
Father, if you want me to defend you, you've got to give give me all the information I need. With all of this medical testimony helping the prosecution, how could you not tell me that a doctor attended the exorcism?
He asked that I keep his involvement confidential. And I said I would.
Erin stares at him with a little disbelief, but she thinks and nods. Then an older man with brown hair, a grey beard and glasses is sitting on a stone bench feeding some pigeons. Erin approaches.
Dr. Cartwright?
Oh, I recognize you from those coat room drawings on the news. You're much prettier in real life.
May I sit?
Yes, please.
He gestures at the bench and nods nervously as Erin sits.
You're losing.
He glances round at Erin.
I'd hope Father Moore wouldn't need me, but I don't want to see him put away.
How do you know him?
Well, I was his parishioner at St. Vincent's Church about 15 years ago. I hadn't seen or heard of him for years when he called me last fall. He needed help, so...
Erin frowns at him.
What kind of help, Doctor?
He wanted a medical perspective from a psychiatrist, you know, one that he knew and trusted, to observe Emily's physical and mental state during this...
During the exorcism?
Yeah.
The pigeons fly away. Dr. Cartwright watches them go, staring upwards, open-mouthed, lost in thought.
Doctor. Doctor.
The man slowly looks back at her.
Can you help our case?
That girl was not schizophrenic, and she was not epileptic or any combination of the two. I've seen hundreds of people with those problems. They can be terrible afflictions, of course, but they don't scare me.
But what you saw that night in Emily, that did scare you.
God, if I'd known, I never would have been there.
He anxiously rubs his forehead.
I started praying again since then, you know.
He nods to himself.
I examined that girl before I drove back to the city that night. She was lucid, and he was completely aware of the separate entity inside her. When she wasn't in his grip, she was totally herself, completely normal. And of course, this awareness of her alternate mental state is counterindicative of psychosis.
Crazy people don't know they're crazy.
That's right.
He'll testify to all of this in detail. Everything you saw.
Send me the case files and tell me when to be in court.
Thank you, Doctor. We need this.
He reaches inside his coat.
Before he was arrested, Father Moore sent this to me. Asked me to take care of it.
It's a little tape recorder.
It's your burden now.
One more thing. When you saw Emily, did Father Moore ask you to give her any medical help?
He was already trying to stop her from injuring herself and urging her to eat. And I told him as a doctor I couldn't help her.
As Erin watches, Dr. Cartwright, hands in his coat pockets, nods and leaves. Then she walks into a prison cell.
Dr. Cartwright's going to testify.
Erin picks up a metal chair and puts it down in front of Moore, who's sitting on the edge of his bed.
Don't you get it? He's not just an eyewitness to the exorcism. He can also refute the prosecution's medical case. This is huge for
when
us.
When do I get to testify?
I don't know. Let's just take this one step at a time.
No. What matters most is Emily's story, which only I can tell.
Erin looks down thoughtfully.
I understand.
In his orange boiler suit, Moore stares at Erin.
Have you thought about what I said before? About dark forces and demonic attacks?
With a look of great concentration, Erin stares back at the priest.
Yes, I have.
She gets up and sits down next to Father Moore on the bed.
That day, after Briggs testified, I was feeling awful. And I went out for a walk just to clear my head, and I was thinking about what you said to me. Thinking, what if demons really do exist? And wondering what that would mean if I believed that. Because God knows, I have my own demons. And I saw something lying on the sidewalk.
Erin is walking along in the snow. There is something shiny on the ground, which she picks up.
It's a gold locket.
with the initials ECB engraved on it. My middle name is Christine. Erin Christine Bruner. And of all the people walking by that day, I found that locket. What are the chances of that?
I don't know. Maybe it was a sign. Or maybe it was just some incredible coincidence, but it made me feel like no matter what mistakes I've made in the past, at that moment, I was exactly where I was meant to be. Like I was on the right path.
The priest looks down and smiles.
You sound more like a mystic than an agnostic. Are you wearing the locket now?
No.
You should.
Erin looks at him with misgiving. She looks down.
The Archdiocese doesn't want you to testify.
The priest gets up.
They're just afraid that I'll embarrass them. Testify to some medieval-sounding supernatural nonsense.
They're expecting me to talk you out of it. I've just decided I'm not even going to try.
Why not?
If the Archdiocese wants to avoid embarrassment, they need you to walk out of here a free man. I believe a jury will find you sincere and credible, and when Dr. Cartwright corroborates your testimony and refutes the prosecution's medical arguments, we'll get an acquittal. And everyone will thank me for it.
Later that night, Erin is asleep in her bed, lying on her side. She sits bolt upright. She looks round at her clock. It's 3 o'clock. She frowns as she thinks to herself. She slowly gets out of her bed and stands in the doorway of her living room. She looks at her desk, on top of which is the little tape player. She goes over to it and presses a button on it. With an expression of unease, she looks down at the little machine. Next day, in the courtroom of the Crescent County Courthouse...
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Father Moore, before you could actually perform the exorcism, you had to get the sanction of the church, correct?
Yes, on October the 27th of last year, I presented my assessment and recommendations to the Archbishop, and he authorized the exorcism that day before I left the office.
Tell us what happened that night.
I drove home. I sat up till after midnight studying the Roman ritual, thinking about what lay ahead.
You mean the Roman ritual of exorcism, a text used by Catholic priests as a guide to the performance of the exorcism rite?
Yes, I think I actually fell asleep with the book in my hand.
What happened next?
I woke up, freezing. It was exactly 3 a.m. 3 a.m. is the demonic witching hour. It's a way for demons to mock the Holy Trinity. It's an inversion of 3 p.m., the miracle hour, which is traditionally accepted as the hour of Christ's death. I thought I smelled something burning. Only later did I connect it, and I remembered that same smell of something burning had been perceived by Emily.
In a flashback, Father Moore gets out of bed and walks across his small, shadowy bedroom. He reaches the door and opens it. The landing is dark. He looks round. He starts to proceed slowly and cautiously along a shadowy corridor. He looks up at a smoke alarm and frowns. The priest touches one of the walls as he walks. He's now open-mouthed, with a little more anxiety. He looks downstairs at a leaded window. Dark liquid suddenly trickles down it.
Holy Mary, Mother of God,
known.
A stained glass monk drips dark blood too. A dark painting of a cathedral is also covered by this spreading blood-like liquid. The priest runs down the stairs. He opens the front door and rushes into the night air. He drops to his knees, panting. It starts to rain. He looks ahead of himself. Standing in front of some more leaded windows, a dark hooded figure. Back in the court.
What did you make of this gesture, this nod in your direction?
I don't know. Some kind of acknowledgement, I guess, that the game is on.
Ethan nods, then chuckles as he turns to the jury.
You're really God's gunslinger, aren't you, Father? Standing tall and facing down the devil with your prayer book at your side.
Objection, Your Honor. Counsel's harassing my witness.
Sustained. Mr. Thomas, you know I won't allow that in my courtroom.
Forgive me, Your Honor.
Ethan paces towards the jury box.
Father, did you understand this black-robed figure to be the devil?
I believe it was a demonic manifestation.
Like the demonic force you believe possessed Emily?
Yes.
Why do you think it appeared to you?
I believe the demonic can appear as an apparition, much like a ghost, in an attempt to excite our fear.
Did it excite your fear, Father?
It scared the hell out of me.
So this night, when you began to prepare Emily's exorcism, was it your first encounter with this demon ghost?
Yes.
Have you seen it again?
Erin is watching intently. She swallows.
I've seen it ever since.
Erin looks down as she thinks. Ethan holds his hands out at the jury.
No further questions at this time.
Erin picks up the little tape player and leans over to her assistant.
Redirect, Your Honor. Father Moore, after you received the bishop's authorization, when did you proceed with an exorcism?
October 31st.
On Halloween? Isn't that a bit dramatic?
The Halloween tradition is based on legends throughout history that indicate a real increase in spiritual activity on that night, and I thought we could use the occasion to draw them into the open.
The demons, you mean?
Yes.
Father Moore.
She puts the tape player in front of him.
Can you identify this?
It's my tape recorder. I used it to record the exorcism. Inside is the tape I made that night.
Why would you make such a tape?
Ever since the technology has been available, exorcists have used tape recorders to authenticate the ritual and provide a record for later review.
I offer into evidence this cassette recorder and audio tape as defense
exhibits
A and B.
People were not made aware of the existence of this tape until late last
night.
Neither
were we, Your Honor. This tape is new evidence that just came into our possession yesterday evening. We have provided counsel for the people with a transcript of its contents.
You mean this tape was not given to you by your client?
No, Your Honor. We received it from a reluctant witness, Dr. Graham Cartwright, who will also be called to testify to its authenticity.
Your Honor,
The people will find his name on the updated witness list we provided to them this morning.
Ethan gestures at his assistant to stop looking through his notes.
Very well. I'll allow it into evidence.
With a wry smile, Ethan sits down.
Father Moore, will you play the tape for us now?
With a sober look at the barrister, Father Moore clicks a button on the tape player.
Exorcism of Emily Rose. Those present are myself, Father Richard Moore. Nathaniel, Emily's father. Jason, her friend. A doctor who is here to monitor Emily during the ritual. And Emily herself, who has given her permission for the ritual to be performed. All right, now listen. You may say the rosary or any private prayer of your own for her deliverance when you're not responding to my words. Above all, do whatever I ask without question. Don't ask it any questions or pay any attention to what it says.
Jason looks at the priest.
It? I won't be dealing with Emily tonight.
Emily is sitting on her bed holding a porcelain-faced old doll.
Restrainer.
As Mr. Rose ties her wrists to the bedhead, the priest picks up a little crucifix and kisses it.
Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on us.
He makes a sign of the cross over Emily, who sits panting. Jason looks at the floor. Father Moore shows the crucifix to Emily in an exaggerated movement. Emily pushes her chest out and tugs on the restraints, staring coldly at the priest.
It has begun. Let us pray.
The other daughters sit on a sofa. One of them gasps as a crucifix on the wall swings upside down.
Because she hopes in you, my God. Send her help from the holy place, Lord. Give her heavenly protection. May the Lord be with you. And with your spirit. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Emily strikes her father with a doll.
My God, you're right.
Of course I'm quite unbidden.
Dolls and kisses and crosses and wishes. You think that that can save your little girl? She throws the doll against the door.
Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those that trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation,
but deliver us from evil!
Who are you, demon? Tell me your name.
The light goes out. Dr. Cartwright looks round at the curtains, which have opened slightly. I am the one who dwells within, she says. In the name of Christ, identify yourself.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Trick or treat, I give you treats and tricks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Moore looks round. A group of cats have gathered at his feet. They leap up at him. He fends them off. Emily releases the other restraint and smashes through her bedroom window. The group of men look up. One of the daughters opens the curtain. Emily is sprinting away. Mr. Rose rushes down the stairs and out into the rain, followed by Father Moore. Father Moore follows. One of the daughters comes out into the rain and stands looking ahead of her. Jason and the doctor rush past her. Inside the barn, Mr. Rose is clinging to his daughter.
She's burning up!
Jason and the doctor now grapple with Emily too.
Hold her down there on the spot! Hold her!
The priest hangs a little oil lamp up over them. One of the other daughters enters the building.
Emily!
The horses in their pens nearby appear anxious. Emily grimaces wildly at the priest.
Doctor, I need you here now.
The doctor hurries towards Emily.
Watch your vital signs.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God.
And the Word was the
and
Word,
the word
what
was
the
God.
Word it was.
Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made.
The barn's back doors are flung open.
And the 70 disciples returned again with joy, saying, Lord, even the devils are subject unto us through thy name.
Her heart is racing. It's almost 180 beats.
I beheld Satan as lightning fall from him. Behold, I give you power to tread on serpents and scorpions, and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you.
Nothing, she says. A snake falls on Moore's back. It wriggles into the straw at his feet. The men look up. A gale-force wind is blowing through the barn. The priest presses his crucifix into Emily's breastbone. She falls to the ground and starts to writhe about. The doctor tries to restrain her, but she grabs him by the throat.
Release him, demon! I command you in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ!
Tell me your name, wicked one.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
He who commands you is he who orders you thrown down from the highest heaven into the depths of hell. In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, I now command you. Tell me your name.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Here, therefore, and fear, Satan, enemy of the faith. Give me your name, demon.
Names!
names.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Shashita!
Ancient serpents. Depart from this servant of God. Tell me your six names.
We are the ones who dwell within.
I am the one who dwelt within Cain. I am the one who dwelt within Nero. I once dwelt within Judas. And I was with Legion. I am Belial.
And I am Lucifer, the devil in the flesh.
It rears up as Emily screams. Mr. Rose goes to it, but it kicks him to the ground. The other horses burst from their pens. Suddenly, Emily's body goes limp and she flops to the ground. Back in the court.
After a few moments, Mr. Rose revived, but the exorcism had to be abandoned. Emily was taken to a room and soon fell into a deep sleep. The whole thing was a complete failure.
Describe her behavior. From the night of the failed exorcism until the time of her death?
Oh, violence towards others and herself. Sometimes she screamed for hours on end. She drove her head through windows, tried to bite holes in the walls, breaking several more of her teeth, as you saw in the post-mortem photograph.
You witnessed this?
Some of it, yes. I tried to visit every day, and the family told me the rest.
Did you attempt another exorcism?
I wanted to, but Emily refused. And without the consent of the possessed, the exorcism ritual can't be performed.
Did you encourage her to eat?
Yes, every time I saw her, but the few times she tried, it seemed like she couldn't swallow or she couldn't keep it down.
What about medical care?
I wanted her to continue. I never said she should quit seeing her doctors. That would have been quite wrong. Medical care is not my field.
But you did suggest she stop taking the drug, Gambutrol.
Father Moore stares at her and nods.
Yes. After the exorcism, she asked for my counsel. She told me that the drugs had never helped her. After all, she was on Gambutrol during the exorcism when her so-called symptoms were at their peak. Ultimately, we both felt that she was beyond medical care and that she had to see this through to the end. By faith alone.
With her arms folded, Erin looks at him with sympathy.
The dual voices we just heard on this tape. You're certain that they were both coming from Emily at the same time?
Yes. Yes, I heard them.
Have you tampered with this tape in any way?
No. No, I have not.
No further questions at this time.
She glances at Moore, then down at Ethan.
Mr. Thomas?
Ethan gets up and whispers something to his seated assistant.
Father Moore, do you consider this tape to be proof of the supernatural?
I think it's a record of certain indications that Emily was possessed. Signs of possession, they're called.
By signs of possession, would you mean her speaking in languages we might assume she couldn't possibly know, and the vocalization of two distinct voices simultaneously?
Yes, among other signs that I observed and described to the court while the tape was playing. Things I saw, things you can't really hear on the tape.
But we'll just have to take you at your word on those, won't we?
Your Honor.
Mr. Thomas.
I apologize. Father, as Emily's parish priest, are you aware that she underwent advanced catechism training?
Yes, yes. Her family is very devout.
And in that training, did she study ancient Greek, Hebrew, and Latin?
Yes, I think that's right.
She might have even spent some time studying Aramaic, the language of Christ and his disciples, which, according to the transcripts, we also heard on the audio tape, correct?
She spoke Aramaic on the tape, but I don't think it was part of her training.
But it was offered as an elective at her catechism school. I have the school's curriculum here in my file, if you'd like to see it.
I'll accept that she might have been exposed to that language.
And according to her high school records, German was the foreign language she studied there, yes?
I don't know, if you say so.
So that pretty much covers all the strange languages we heard on the tape, correct? Did I miss any?
No.
Good. Now, Father, we've already established that you're no medical expert. As you said, that's not your field. But are you aware of the dual sets of vocal cords that every human possesses?
No.
Have you heard of the superior vocal cords, which are a bit higher than the primary ones we use to speak?
No.
No. So you didn't know that Tibetan monks, for example, as part of their religious training, actually teach themselves to activate both sets of vocal cords at once?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, now that you do know, would you think it's possible that Emily, in her psychotic state, might have activated both of her sets of vocal cords so as to achieve the amazing effect we heard captured on your audio tape?
Her state was not psychotic.
Father Moore, you told us that in the exorcism we just heard, you actually saw, once again, this black-robed figure or demonic apparition. Am I right?
Yes.
But of course we couldn't see him when you played the tape, correct?
No, of course not.
No, of course not. So that would be yet another supernatural aspect of the exorcism that your tape doesn't prove, correct?
Yes.
Where is your dark figure, Father? Is he here now? Do I look like your demon ghost?
Your Honor.
Counselor.
Ethan retreats from leaning over at Father Moore.
I have nothing further.
Does the defense wish to redirect?
No, Your Honor, but we reserve the right to recall the witness at a later time.
Very well, the witness may step down.
Erin's assistant whispers something in her ear as he passes her. Father Moore crosses in front of her back to his seat.
Your Honor, my next witness must have been detained. If we could take a short recess so I
You've made this court wait before, Counselor. I'm inclined
Your
to
Honor,
continue.
Please. Dr. Cartwright came to us in good conscience. As an eyewitness to the exorcism on Father Moore's tape, he can substantiate all of my client's testimony.
Your Honor, the defense has already presented its exorcism testimony in dramatic fashion. Do we really have to...
The judge is holding up her hand to silence him. Erin glances over at him.
We have absorbed some extraordinary testimony today. I think we'll take some time to consider it. Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Then in the lobby of the court building...
What do you mean you can't find him?
I went to meet him and he didn't show. I called his office, I called his house.
Okay. Go to the hospital, ask around. Somebody's got to know where he is.
Erin is outside the building, walking along the pavement. Winter leaves are strewn along the ground. She glances round and stops. Dr. Cartwright is shambling along nearby. She strides over to him.
What the hell happened?
Tell Father Moore I'm sorry. Tell him I know the demons are real, and I admire his courage for standing and speaking against them. Tell him I know what they can do.
He suddenly spots something over Erin's shoulder. He looks terrified. He retreats. Erin turns round. Dr. Cartwright is thrown onto the bonnet of a car that has sped into him. He smashes through its windscreen. Then Erin is sitting in her office, pouring some whiskey into a mug. Carl enters. Erin looks round at him sheepishly.
Cartwright's dead.
I heard. Are you drunk?
Not yet, but I'm working on it.
Have you seen this?
The newspaper's headline, "The Devil and Father Moore, Priest Describes Encounter with Demonic Ghost."
What the hell were you thinking?
Carl.
You told me you'd talk him out of testifying. Instead, you put on a freak show with tape-recorded demons and a dead girl speaking in tongues, and your client testifies that the Archbishop sanctioned the exorcism. We'll be lucky if the Archdiocese isn't named in additional charges.
I had a doctor who was going to corroborate. Besides that, Father Moore's testimony is crucial to his defense.
Have you forgotten that the Archdiocese is paying for this defense?
The Archdiocese isn't on trial. I swore an oath to do what's best for my client.
Spare me the law school pieties, Bruner. You cashed in your conscience at the door.
People can change.
Like James Van Hopper?
Erin stares at him with tears in her eyes.
It's not over. I can put Mr. Rose on the stand to corroborate Father Moore about the exorcism, and there are the girls. Her sister, Alice, she saw part of it.
They all look like superstitious rubes. They've got no credibility. Ethan Thomas will rip them to pieces. You'll be worse off than you are now, if that's possible.
You're going to replace me on this case.
You've screwed it up beyond all repair. But the Archdiocese feels that replacing you now would only draw more unnecessary attention to the trial. But just so we're clear, Bruner, if you put that priest on the stand again, I will fire you.
Erin nods, and Carl walks out of the room. Erin's lower lip trembles as she fights her tears. She puts her face in her hands. Then the door of a prison cell is opened, and Erin steps into the cell, looking gravely concerned. Father Moore, sitting reading, swings round so he's now on the edge of his bed.
You've been crying.
Dr. Cartwright is dead.
What?
He was killed. It was an accident. I'm sorry.
The priest has his hand to his mouth. He bows his head.
I know it was your friend.
Erin leans against the wall, arms folded.
We've lost. Without his testimony, it's over.
No. No, 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 it isn't over. We're telling Emily's story. That's what matters.
It can't be worth all this.
Yes, yes, it is worth it. Just let me go back on the stand and tell the rest of
that,
the story,
Father.
And then you'll know.
I can't do that.
You must. You must.
Father Moore crosses back to his bed and picks up a folded piece of paper.
Erin, you once said that you felt you were on the right path. Don't stray from that path. Here, take this.
What is this?
Just read it, and then decide what you want to do. I saw your eyes today in court when I explained the significance of 3 a.m. It's not going to stop until Emily's story is told.
Later that night, Erin is in her bedroom wearing a pink T-shirt. She moves over to her alarm clock and turns it round. She holds up the envelope addressed to Father Moore. She pulls out the handwritten letter and starts to read it. She sits cross-legged on her sofa looking down at the letter. The next day, Erin and her assistant make their way towards the courthouse through a throng of reporters. Inside the courtroom, Erin is wearing the little gold pendant around her neck. She looks round at Carl, who's sitting amongst the members of the public behind her.
Is the defense ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. The defense recalls Father Richard Moore.
Carl's face hardens. As the priest gets to his feet, so Carl stands and leaves the court.
The witness is reminded that he is still under oath.
Erin walks somberly towards the jury box. She composes herself for a moment.
When did you last see Emily alive?
The night before she died. Her mother, Maria, called me and said that Emily had asked for me.
Why did she ask to see you?
To give me this.
Did Emily explain to you the letter's significance?
Yes. She said she'd written it the morning after the failed exorcism and that it was important for me to share.
Erin folds her arms and takes a few paces away.
Father Moore, was Emily a good person?
I believe that one day Emily will be recognized as a saint.
So she loved God?
Yes, she was very devout.
Father Moore, if Emily loved God, if she was so good and so devout, why do you think God allowed this to happen?
Objection.
To her?
What can possibly be the relevance,
Your Honor,
of that question?
Father Moore's
sheer
belief in this matter is crucial in establishing his and Emily's understanding of her condition. And that mutual understanding is paramount in determining whether Father Moore was, in fact, negligent.
I'm going to allow it.
Your Honor, you're not really going to let someone testify in a court of law about why God would allow the death of a young
critical.
Girl?
The objection has been overruled.
Again, Father Moore, why did God allow Emily to become possessed by demons and then die?
I can let Emily answer that.
He puts on his glasses and unfolds the letter.
Last night, on All Hallows' Eve, Father Moore tried to cast 6 demons from my body. They refused to go. After the attempted exorcism, I was taken to
my room, and I fell into a deep sleep. I awoke a few hours later, hearing a voice calling out my name.
Emily sits up in her bed. She has a bruised face and dark rings around her eyes. She steps out of the front door, still wearing her yellow nightshirt. She walks slowly into the fog surrounding the house. In the middle of a field, a solitary old tree bereft of leaves. Emily proceeds cautiously through the fog towards it. She lies down on her back on the ground in front of it, staring upwards. Standing at her feet, looking down at her, another Emily Rose. Her nightshirt is white. Her face is unblemished. She walks away.
Again, I heard a voice calling my name. It was the Blessed Holy Mother of God. And when I looked at her, she smiled at me and said, "Emily, heaven is not blind to your pain."
She said the Virgin Mary spoke to her in the middle of a field.
Yes.
And do you believe her?
I believe Emily spoke the truth.
Please continue.
I asked the Blessed Mother, "Why do I suffer like this?
Why did the demons not leave me tonight?"
She said, "I am sorry, Emily. The demons are going to stay where they are." Then she said, "You can come with me in peace, freed of your bodily form, or you can choose to continue this. You will suffer greatly, but through you, many will come to see that the realm of the spirit is real. The choice is yours."
In the field, the new Emily exhales unhappily.
"I choose to stay."
She's knocked backwards to the ground. She writhes around and moves on her back towards the old Emily. Then the original Emily gets up slowly from where she'd been lying. She looks down at her hands, which have two bloody marks in the palms.
"In the end, good will triumph over evil. Through my experience, people will know that demons are real. People say that God is dead."
He frowns and shakes his head.
"But how can they think that if I show them the devil?"
He rubs his nose with his hand.
"Did you see these wounds on both of Emily's hands and both feet?"
"Yes. Yes, the wounds lasted for some time."
"And did you attach any supernatural significance to these wounds?"
"I believe they were stigmata."
"By that you mean supernatural injuries that correspond to the crucifixion wounds of Jesus Christ?"
"Yes. Stigmata are a sign, a mark indicating one is touched by God."
Erin nods and looks towards the jury.
"After that night, why do you think Emily refused another exorcism?"
"I believe she'd accepted her fate."
"Is there anything else you'd like to say about Emily?"
Father Moore thinks to himself.
"No."
Erin stands up straight and looks at the jury.
"The defense rests."
She walks away. Later, Ethan is pacing in front of the jury box.
"Father Moore attaches divine significance to the wounds on Emily's hands and feet. Why? Because he sees them as confirmation of what he wants to believe. That Emily was a saint, touched by the hand of God. I'm afraid the truth is far less inspiring, because the truth is, by the time these miraculous wounds appeared, Emily had already shown a tendency to injure herself, and simply did so again on one of the barbed wire fences surrounding the Rose family farm."
Emily is gripping one of the barbed wire fences.
"Father Moore's beliefs are based on archaic and irrational superstition. Emily suffered because she was sick, not because she was a saint. I'm a man of faith, and I am also a man of facts. And in here, facts are what must matter. And these are the facts of this case. Emily Rose had epilepsy, which caused psychosis, and given time, medicine would have cured her. But it didn't. Why? Because Father Richard Moore convinced Emily that she wasn't ill, that she didn't need medicine. And in the weeks leading up to her death, when she was clearly in need of medical treatment, he failed to have her hospitalized.
He pins up an enlarged photo of Emily's bruised face on a lectern in front of the jury box.
So, the defense has given us an extraordinary, creative explanation for the events that led to this. Ladies and gentlemen, don't you believe it? Because the fact is, it wasn't the devil that did this to Emily Rose.
He points to Father Moore and the defense table.
It was the defendant.
The priest stares forward. Ethan glares at the jury and moves back to his chair. Erin watches him as he sits. The judge stares at Erin.
Counselor.
Erin remains in her seat for a moment, thoughtful. Ethan turns to look at her.
Ethan Thomas calls himself a man of faith.
Ethan looks away.
I, on the other hand, am a woman of doubt.
She stands up and proceeds towards the jury.
Angels and demons. God and the devil.
She leans on the lectern facing the jury.
These things either exist or they do not exist. Are we all alone in this life? Or are we not alone? Either thought is astonishing.
She moves round to the front of the lectern and looks at the image of Emily.
Do I really believe that this tragedy is the work of the devil? To be honest, I don't know. But I cannot deny that it's possible. The prosecution wants you to believe that Emily's psychotic epileptic disorder was a fact, because facts leave no room for reasonable doubt. But this trial isn't about facts. This trial is about possibilities. Is it a fact that Emily was a hypersensitive, as Dr. Adani suggests, a person who's more likely by her very nature to become possessed? I can't say that, but the question is it possible? Is it a fact that Gambutrol anesthetized Emily's brain so that the exorcism ritual was rendered ineffective? I can't be sure of that. But is it possible? Is it a fact that Emily was beloved by God? And that after her exorcism, she chose to suffer till the end so that we might believe in a more magical world, a world where the spiritual realm really exists? I can't say that's a fact. But ask yourself.
She looks at each of the jury members.
Is it possible? It's what Emily believed. It's what Father Moore believed. And that sincere belief is what determined her choices and his. Now, for the most important question, is Father Richard Moore guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of negligent homicide? Did he, in fact, neglect Emily's needs in such a way that her death is now on his hands? No, that is not a fact. It is not a fact that Emily was epileptic. It is not a fact that she was psychotic. Facts leave no room for possibilities. The only fact, the only thing I know beyond a doubt in this case is that Father Moore loved Emily with his whole heart. He did everything in his power to help her. He has risked his very freedom so we could hear her story.
She stares at the jury, then shakes her head and turns away.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, in my job, I sometimes have to defend bad men. Father Richard Moore is not one of them. Don't send a good man to prison. I'm not asking that you believe everything that Father Moore believes. I'm simply asking that you believe in Father Moore.
She looks at them a moment longer. She looks down, then heads slowly across the room back to her seat. Time passes.
Madam Foreman, has the jury reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
A folded slip of paper is handed to the judge. She unfolds it and reads it. Erin, her assistant, and the priest are all standing at their table.
Please read the verdict out loud.
A policeman hands the forewoman who is standing in the jury box the piece of paper.
In the case of the people versus Father Richard Moore, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty of negligent homicide.
Erin thinks to herself.
The court thanks the jury for its service. Sentencing for this case will be set for April 3rd.
Your Honor, if it pleases the court, Father Moore requested at the start of trial that if found guilty, he would be sentenced immediately.
Yes, I recall that. Does the prosecution have any objection to expedited sentencing?
Ethan shakes his head.
Very well.
The judge closes a file and puts the top on her pen.
Father Richard Moore, do you understand this sentence which has been found against you?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you understand the gravity of this crime, that you may, under the law, be sentenced to a term of up to 10 years?
Yes, I do.
Are there any statements you would like to make before I impose this sentence?
No, Your Honor.
Very well.
Excuse me, Your Honor. But the jury would like to make a recommendation regarding this
objection.
Sentence. Sit down, Counselor. It's only a recommendation, and I would like to hear it.
She looks round at the forewoman.
We recommend a sentence of time served.
The judge frowns as she thinks. She looks out at the packed courtroom. Ethan, motionless, watches her.
I'll accept that.
Erin touches Father Moore's arm. Ethan shifts in his seat.
You are guilty, Father Moore. And you are free to go.
The priest nods.
This court is dismissed.
All rise!
Erin and Father Moore look at each other in disbelief, open-mouthed.
Thank you.
Shocked us all. Everyone at the firm sees this as another victory. The archdiocese is pleased. They feel the trial has raised public interest in the church. Have you seen the news? There's our priest leaving the courthouse a free man right next to you.
Just like James Van Hopper.
Carl smiles at her.
All right, I'll say it. I was wrong, but I'm ready to make it right. I'm offering you a full partnership in the firm.
Erin smiles.
Keep it. Will you be able to return to your parish?
I can't go back. Not now. Once you've looked into the darkness, I think you carry it with you for the rest of your life. What about you? I believe you've seen the darkness too.
I don't know. I'm not sure what I've seen. Who chose the epitaph?
I did. It's from the second chapter of Philippians, verse 12. Emily recited it to me the night before she died.
Erin, wearing a green Macintosh, bends down and rests a single white rose against the gravestone. The epitaph reads, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." Later that night, back in her apartment, Erin is packing up the trial paperwork into boxes. She writes on the side of one and deposits it onto the floor. She turns off her bedside light. In the shadows, she gets into bed. She lays her head down on a pillow, which she grips tightly. She reaches across to the alarm clock on the bedside table and turns it the right way round. She looks at it for a moment and is thoughtful as she lies in the darkness. She closes her eyes. As Emily predicted, her story has affected many people. Emily's gravesite has become an unofficial holy shrine which continues to draw visitors from all over the world. After the trial, Father Moore went into seclusion, refusing to appeal his guilty conviction and stating, "This is a matter for God. Worldly courts cannot pass any judgment on it." Erin Bruner shared her case files with an expert in medical research and anthropology, whose further research and published work about the life and death of Emily Rose inspired this film. The End.